Please be seated. Do we need to know anything before we proceed with you, Ms. Dixon, about any discussions over the morning adjournment? Anything that Mr. Moore wants to tell the court?
Yes, there is an update to provide, and yep. Ms. Mallett has been working furiously over the break and can provide that update. Yep.
Ms. Mallett.
So, Your Honour, in terms of the primary sector expert conferencing, we mm-hmm. do have agreed or dates where parties can be available for that, being the 24th and 25th of March.
Is that next week?
That's next week.
And what days are those? Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday?
Wednesday, Thursday is my understanding.
24th. Wednesday, Thursday. And have you got a venue or are you wanting the court to find a venue?
We don't have a venue as yet, so I can liaise with the yep. court around finding a venue.
Okay, so you'll need to, we'll be, obviously having a venue is one of those important things, which is why the dates are important as well. We'll feed that back to Karina Kelly, who's the mediations manager. We'll say that those are the dates, 24, 25, and there's to be cooperation as to the location of the venue. I'm not sure whether she's begun her search yet or she could have just been waiting for the days. But unless anybody has serious objections, ORC is one of those potential venues, particularly if unless objections because it's not neutral ground. Any thoughts about that? No thoughts about that. Okay. Good. All right. So we'll leave that in hand. We'll let Karina Kelly to know, also Ross to know that plan for the primary sector next week. Yep.
And we were working through options for the hydro and community water supplies conferencing, yep. and we were working on the basis of the 30th and 31st of March. But then if the court is wanting to have that conferencing take place this week, Mr. Wilson, we have made further inquiries around the meeting that he is required to attend. Mm-hmm. He has had approval from a manager that he can for him not to attend that meeting. It does expose the council to some risk in terms of it's been involved in a process to date and now Mr. Wilson won't be able to participate, but if the conferencing does need to go ahead this week, that can be accommodated, or if it follows the primary sector conferencing, I have liaised with other council and witnesses are available the 30th and 31st of March.
Well, there's no imperative for the conferencing to happen this week other than parties want a TA and hydro to take place prior to the primary sector. We're agnostic because we're not expecting to see the outputs of those conferences until they're ready to be filed because they need to... Yeah. It's a process to manage with Mr. Dunlop. You'll have three conference outputs which are then transmitted to the planners, which are then transmitted in some form to the court. There may need to be, as I said, reconciliation across the three, whether it's one schedule and then end up with all three schedules or something else entirely, I don't know. But you'll have to think about the question of transmission. Now, it may well be that the parties will want to see the technical outputs prior to the planners. Really looking for your guidance on this.
Yes, and in terms of the sequencing of conferencing, I guess from the council's point of view, the preference would be to have that primary sector conferencing first yeah. and then the hydro and community water supply conferencing. Now, the planners for hydro and community water supplies are attending those conferencing days, so they will be in the room. And then a follow-up planning conferencing session in the days between the 7th and 9th of April, but I am still confirming availability for those dates given other parties' planners' availability. But that was the, in terms of the sequencing of it, how we anticipated that would work.
All right, the 7th and 9th, and that's, what was that? 7th and 9th, or 7th and 8th?
There's 3 days between the 7th and 9th of April that we're confirming availability for the planners to conference.
Yeah, with a two-day conference.
Yes.
For planners. All right, well, that sounds sensible in terms of subject to confirmation. That sounds like a sensible plan. And the if we release a minute to that effect, it will be subject to further direction of Mr. Dunlop.
Yes, Your Honour. Mm. And to update you in relation to the scenarios, Council for ORUG has provided a list of scenarios to, and they've been working with LANPRO on that. They have provided that to the Regional Council, and Mr. Wilson and Mr. Leslie are working on that this morning and liaising with the other expert witnesses around the practical. We have a long list of resource consent examples, and they're working through the practicalities of how the parties would actually work through that in conferencing, and therefore the scenarios that they are working on. So that is being progressed this morning, Your Honour.
So there's always a possibility that a conference is simply going to be killed by overloading the conference with the sheer volume of data and information, which may or may not be particularly necessary to test the various proposals which are out there. And so that needs to be considered as well.
Yes, and it depends on the expectations of other experts as to what they were actually physically going to work through in the room versus work done prior to the conferencing and how that works. So the experts are talking to each other about that at the moment.
Yeah. So two observations. One is that there had to be an agreed data set and to get an agreed list of scenarios. If not agreed, then a list of scenarios.
Yes.
Preferably agreed. But you can't get the list of scenarios so broad that you're going to kill that conference. That should not be an outcome of the list of scenarios, but you have to be testing what are probable or likely scenarios that are, you know, that this plan change will need to respond to in some way. That's just your first step, and it should have been with us on Friday, but I understand it's still being worked on. The second step, and this was the step that I was going to leave to Mr. Dunlop, was then what pre-ADR work has to be undertaken by each of the interested parties. So with that scenario and that data set then run, your preferred methodology was how I saw it working out, with exchange of data. Whether it's, I don't know, an Excel spreadsheet, I'm not quite sure how that all works out, but just say that the methodology is embedded into an Excel spreadsheet that is run for ORC's witnesses and then transmitted as such to the witnesses for the other parties who will do likewise. Now, they may not be running off Excel, but we actually have to understand what is the program, the software or whatever, which is underlying the preferred methodology, so it's visible and so that everybody can satisfy themselves that what is being run is actually transparent and repeatable, so that there's a basis then to go into conference. You don't want to run the thing in conference. I would not have thought. Anyway, we won't allow it, so that's why I have to allow yourself some time.
Yes, and that's what I understand they are working through at the moment in terms of the practicalities and ensuring that what is being worked through is worked through in a transparent manner as well. And there's time. It takes time to work through each of those scenarios, so they're needing to factor that in as well.
So is there anything that I haven't, in terms of what the court's expectations are, firstly being on the same page with the data set and the selection of scenarios, is there anything that needs clarification as to what the court's expectation of this process is? Firstly, getting yourselves on the same page. No. Then secondly, that there may be, there probably highly likely to be some event where parties then prove or test their preferred methodology using the data set and using the examples given, as at least to form some basis for discussion, and that be circulated in a way that other witnesses can test the underlying assumptions or parameters. No difficulty with that? We're all on the same page? All right. So you'll be with us today about these scenarios?
They are working on that, and I will get an update at lunchtime.
Oh, good. It's just that Mr. Dunlop asked me at morning tea, you see, so where were they? So he's on top of that, and he's chasing me, so I'm chasing you. And so that's how it goes.
Yes, find out and update it at lunchtime.
Right. Very good. All right. Thank you. Anything else? No. Okay.
Can I just clarify, the TA Hydro conference we now agreed will be the 30th, 31st March?
I not think so.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's... No, it's not. It'll run when it's convenient. I mean, Ross does it, as far as I'm aware, doesn't he? So subject to commissioner availability, subject also to the court being able to put in resources, such as the venue, and other resources which are required, it'll be running on the later days. And on the matter of other resources, court's made its requirements quite clear about what is to be in the room, including also a scribe, which is familiar, who is familiar with, you know, the topic for discussion. It's not really helpful getting in a planner or somebody else who has no idea what this might all be about. Shouldn't be a witness, obviously, but somebody who's actually at least has a working knowledge of the methodologies, being in the room as the scribe.
Yes, that's certainly something the council's alive to, and somebody had been identified that would have sufficient background understanding, but who's not appearing in the case as a witness. So we'll make sure that that person or somebody like that person is available to scribe.
And you might need to talk to folk here. And the only other thing that came up, that'll be fine. The only other thing that came up in the memorandum that I was somewhat surprised was that parties didn't require wise response. Actually, that's not your call, is it? Mm. Bit cheeky even saying that. So if I have a party who has called an expert or somebody who can qualify themselves as an expert who has made a submission on a relevant matter, they're entitled to be there. Unless they're entitled to be there, and ordinarily the court would direct them there. I had thought maybe Mr. McIntosh, is it?
McTavish.
He was representing Wise Response, but it looks like it's Dr. Rennie who is representing Wise Response, and Dr. Rennie is the advocate. So I can't see that there would be a problem in principle with Mr. McTavish if he has an interest. If Wise has made a submission on point, I can't see why they would be excluded. And indeed, and I thought I had made this point clear, that when we were actually talking about this expert conferencing, I had assumed that parties were bringing in contact with everybody else who might have an interest who'd called expert evidence.
Yes, the issue, as I recall, was a question of whether it was expert evidence.
Yeah, that's right.
Why it had been
framed. Looks like Dr. Rennie's giving is the advocate.
Mm. Yes, well, that being the case, we'll liaise with Mr. or Dr. McTavish, with Mr. McTavish, and check his availability.
Okay, thank you. Right, anything else? No, except you, Ms. Dixon, for the rest of your submission.
We were at paragraph 30, Your Honour. I was about to talk about the legal framework and, in fact, really about two legal issues that I think arise. But at paragraph 30, I've said essentially that the various planning witnesses have discussed the legislative framework that applies, including Part 2 matters, and they don't appear to be in contention. Objective 10A 1.1, while it may need some tweaking, and obviously that is still being worked on, achieves the overriding purpose of the RMA by facilitating the transition towards a new long-term management regime for the region's freshwater resources that will be contained in the plan to come. Regarding Section 8, the Council has provided a memorandum which sets out how the Council has applied treaty principles to PC7. Te Runanga o Ngāi Tahu, o Kaha, and Te Ao Marama, Inc., have expressed a level of satisfaction and comfort with PC7. And I think that was the gist, really, of Mr. Winchester's case to you last week. The Minister's power to make recommendation or to make the recommendation that he did regarding a plan change under Section 24A of the RMA doesn't appear to be an issue. So there are two legal issues that I do wish to address. First is the weight to be given to the Minister's reasons for making the direction that PC7 be referred to the Environment Court, but I should add in there the weight also to be given to his recommendation regarding the plan change and the appropriate approach to national policy statements in this plan change. So the heading that follows, weight to be given to Minister's direction, should also say and recommendations. On request of the Council, the Minister called the proposal in by way of his powers in Section 24 and pursuant to Section 142 of the RMA. Section 149U1A provides that the Court must have regard to the Minister's reasons for making the direction. Have regard to requires the decision maker to give genuine attention and thought to the matter. In the direction, the Minister stated that PC7 is a proposal of national significance. And at 35, I have set out what is contained in the direction. Unless you wish me to, I wasn't going to go through those.
Indeed, no. No.
So at 36, the direction states that calling in PC7 as part of a proposal of national significance and referring it to the Environment Court for decision would assist the Council by allowing its staff to focus on developing the proposed regional plan and avoid potential delays associated with the Schedule 1 process of the RMA that could complicate the development of a new regional plan. In his opening legal submissions for the Council, Mr Moore has explored the weight to be given to the Minister's direction and also the relevance of the Minister's recommendations and the Skelton Report. He notes that the Minister's recommendations do not fall within the matters listed in Section 66(1), that the Court must act in accordance with when considering a change to a regional plan, or the matters listed in Section 66(2) that the Court must have regard to when considering a change to a regional plan. Therefore, in his submission, the Court is not required to consider the Minister's recommendations when considering PC7. He goes on to submit that the Court should nevertheless have regard to the Minister's recommendation when making a decision on PC7, as Section 66(2) is not an exhaustive list of matters to be considered. He goes on in his submissions to note that the Minister's recommendations are relevant background material to PC7 and should be given weight accordingly. And then I have quoted Mr Moore from his paragraph 75.
I just want to read that again.
Mr Moore goes on to point to the directive powers in sections 24 and 25 that underlie that. Finally, Mr Moore submits that given the close link between the Minister's recommendations under Section 24A and the Minister's reasons for making the direction and the fact that the Court must have regard to those reasons when considering PC7, it is appropriate for the Court to place weight on the Skelton Report and the Minister's recommendations when considering PC7.
So can I ask you?
I adopt that submission.
Right, thank you. Can I ask you what is recommendation and what is reason? Have you addressed that in your submission? What was the recommendation as opposed to what were the reasons? Have you got a reference to that?
The recommendation is the question of the way recommendation 3 is framed around the adequate interim planning and consenting framework to manage fresh water, etc. So the specific recommendation, well, the Minister made a number, of course, in terms of covering the whole approach.
So this submission is directed. So it's recommendation 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm specifically talking about there.
Right. I might actually get that submission in front just to make sure that we're all on the right page, same page. So that was this was attached to Mr. Placemaker's evidence, Palsmaker's evidence.
Yes, the letter, well, the Minister's letter with the recommendations, I think it's Appendix D to Mr. Pilsmaker, and then the Council's response following the extraordinary meeting that we were talking about earlier, in which they adopt that recommendation 3.
All right.
Just... is the Volume 5, Tab 12E, CB1550 letter. So that's the recommendation I'm talking about, that specifically frames the Minister's expectations around what this plan change will do, and then the Council's response affirming that recommendation.
So I have now before me Appendix D of Mr. Palsmaker's evidence in chief, and that's a letter from the Minister, the Honourable David Parker, to the Chair and Councillors of the Otago Regional Council. And your submission is not directed at recommendations 1 and 2, but is directed at recommendation 3.
In this case, Your Honour, yes, because that's the specific recommendation that deals with PC7 and therefore is relevant to these proceedings. And I would also submit, in terms of this question as to whether or not Mr. Pilsmaker is reflecting in adjusting his position to streamline the plan change more, whether he's reflecting his own view as an expert planner or whether he's reflecting where Council is coming from, that if you look at what Council has said it is doing in terms of that extraordinary meeting and the minutes of that and then this letter to the Minister, in my submission, he is reflecting the position that Council had intended to adopt. That's not to say that every single thing that's in Mr. De Pilsmaker's proposed version of last night. The latest one.
Yeah, the latest one,
I would reserve some position around the drafting.
Oh, no, understood, yeah.
But it's heading, that is what Council intended by this plan change.
Yes, but I think also, though, that's what they intended, and then they notified something that I think you... you described as being environmental plus, so that's what they intended, but the instrument, the planning document they notified went beyond that intention. That seems to be what he is saying.
It starts to,
yes.
And that's, I was talking earlier about trying to get this balance between making this thing work and just kind of rolling over what was there and actually using the opportunity that the plan change provides to set some environmental bottom lines, but are nevertheless ones that apply with certainty and don't require a lot of discretion on the council. I'm going to come to that actually, but a lot of discretion on the council processing.
In asking you the question, though, I take it that there's no issue that it is the notified plan that people made submissions on.
Yes.
And, you know, if they saw something in that notified plan, and particularly in terms of the controlled activity rule and the matters of discretion there, or indeed perhaps the policies that they wish to advance, but which the council's now, or Mr. De Plaismaker has retreated from, they can still advance that because that's a submission on the notified plan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
all right. So I know that the submission's particularly directed to recommendation 3 and of Appendix D, which is the letter by the minister, and the reasons for that recommendation. We're talking about the reasons for the recommendation, and again, I want to make sure that I'm addressing the right thing at the right time. The reasons are those.
The reasons are really set out. They're set out in the minister's letter with the Skelton report, and also reflected back to the minister in the way in which the letter of the 16 December letter from the Honourable Marion Hobbs to David Parker.
But the reasons for the Minister's recommendation, are they those matters that you quote at paragraph 35 of your submissions? Well, no, that's a different document.
No,
altogether,
that's dealing with the calling in.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Your Honour.
So the reasons are those which are the reasoning contained in Appendix D as a whole.
Yes, and particularly in his letter to Council containing the recommendation following his receipt of the Skelton report.
Mm. Okay.
Perhaps just one final point on that, Your Honour, and that is to say that given the way that Council adopted the recommendation, the way they reflect the Minister's language back to him, we're talking about giving weight to something where, in fact, Council and the Minister are not inconsistent. They're on the same page. So giving weight to the Minister's thinking is in effect applying what the Council themselves chose to do in any case. So moving on then to national policy statements. We're all agreed, a regional plan must give effect to any national policy statement, and the one that is obviously first up is the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management 2020. It came into force on the 3rd of September last year, and despite the fact that it was the 2014, as amended in 2017 NPS, that was in force when PC7 was re-notified by the EPA on the 6th of July, it is no longer relevant. Mm-hmm. The NPS 2020 sets the direction for freshwater quality and quantity management in New Zealand, states objectives and policies for the management of freshwater through a framework that considers and recognises Te Mana o Te Wai as an integral part of freshwater management. It requires the management of freshwater to prevent further overallocation and to phase out existing overallocation. The objective introduces a hierarchy of obligations in Te Mana o Te Wai that prioritises, first of all, the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems. And I know that you've been taken through this, but second, the health needs of people, and that includes drinking water, and thirdly, the ability of people and communities to provide for their social, economic and cultural well-being. Consequently, the NPSFM requires a comprehensive review of freshwater management in Otago. Granting individual long-term consents prior to this process taking place has the potential to make implementation of the NPS more difficult. It would require the review of more resource consents down the track. Importantly, given the first priority under the objective is the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems, granting long-term consents may undermine efforts to give effect to the NPS through the new plan. Clause 4.1 provides that every local authority must give effect to this national policy statement as soon as reasonably practicable. Councils have until 31 December 2024 to notify planning instruments that fully give effect to the NPS. All parties in this matter appear to agree that the NPS FM 2020 applies. At issue is the extent to which it should be given effect in this plan change. The NPS 2020 anticipates progressive implementation. Council accepts that until certain implementation steps have been followed, as set out in Part 3, the NPS cannot be given effect too fully. Many of these steps require substantial tangata whenua and community involvement with regional councils, and giving effect to the NPS is also limited by the scope of submissions. Given these factors, the clear limited intent of PC7 and the need to ensure that this plan change works in the interim so that the coming plan can address overallocation as required by the NPS in future, it's appropriate that only the essential aspects of the NPS FM 2020 are incorporated. Such an approach is in the interests of a regional plan that is limited and responsive to the need to enable short terms to be imposed. Sorry, a regional plan change, that should say. Limited and responsive to the need to enable short terms to be imposed on the consents now being sought in large numbers. And I understand that the court is considering this and the policies that may apply to such an approach. Now, I footnoted the policies that we have talked about this morning, 3.221 regarding wetlands, 3.241 regarding rivers, at 3.261 regarding fish passage. And I've made the point in a footnote that, given this morning's discussion, requires some addressing, that to require that clause 1.7 of the preamble applies section 55(2)(a) of the RMA to require the immediate amendment and inclusion of these clauses into the current plan. And my point is that that does not mean these additions need to be addressed specifically in PC7. And I note that that's also the position that Mr. De Pilsmaker has taken, I think, in his supplementary brief of evidence. Mm-hmm. And my submission is that these matters are mandatory or they are required matters that must go into the regional plan, and that is the effect of subsection 2A of section 55. I certainly don't dispute that, but that doesn't mean that it has to be this plan change that does it. My understanding is that councils have their own procedures for simply doing what the NPS anticipates, which is that they put these into the plan other than through the Schedule 1 process. And there's no particular time frame for doing that. So I would imagine, for example, given that there's a little bit of leeway about exactly the language that's used, that it can be words to like effect as well as the exact language that is used in the NPS. I would imagine that a council has to go through the process, for example, of deciding where is the most appropriate place to incorporate these three new provisions into its regional plan, given every regional plan has a slightly different structure. So in my submission, I would assume that a council would work through that process and would do that itself through the regional plan without the Schedule 1 process, but not necessarily through PC7 either.
All right, well, we'll think about that over lunch. Mm. And it's not that the court is considering... the court is simply raising this to understand whether these things already are inferred to be included in the operative plan and all this plan change because of the provisions in the NPS. Because if they are, then how did they get addressed? So yes. It's just closing, yes. Again, trying to understand what are the four corners of the problem that we're addressing.
And I suppose my submission is that, yes, that is for the council to address. Mm. But there's room for the council as to exactly how they do that.
How
it doesn't
do it.
Have to be through PC7.
Mm.
Which is different, I think, from the question about what happens in relation to Te Manawa Te Wai, which I know you have discussed with my friends last week as well, which, yes, I think the word that was used last week was infuses. Someone used the word infuses, must infuse the plan change because it is now absolutely central to the way in which the NPSFM operates.
Mm.
And I would submit that has to be correct. But that, again, that in a practical sense, that probably means that what's going into this plan change when we look at the drafting has to be tested against that position. It's not that anything in particular has to go in as a result of Te Manawa Te Wai.
And I think that was a proposition that I had last week to the court, was insofar as that there are many different interests and, well, I don't know, forgotten how much relief we've got, just say 20 different positions of relief. How does one reconcile that? And the proposition that I had is that gets reconciled directly under the foundational principle, not necessarily under Tier 1 or Tier 2 or Tier 3, but the foundational principle itself, because it's that which is infusing. My proposition is every provision of this plan change. And I wanted to... What's your thoughts about that, right, wrong, or could it be better expressed, or something different?
I think it's right, but it doesn't direct any specific content in
no,
this case.
No.
It, I guess the way I put it a moment ago, it means that wherever the planners and the court lands on the drafting and the content of this plan change, it has to circle back and make sure that Te Mātauratawai is there in any decisions that are made.
Mm.
Which is kind of the first time we've been in this position exactly. I mean, this is the new NPS.
I think it's the first time for this plan change, but it's not the first time for the court, because we dealt with something similar in Southland.
Yes.
And there the council in partnership with Ngāi Tahu, the court's decision was, had written the provisions of the plan change, if you like, with Te Mānawatawai infused in each and every provision. So it was brought into account in the drafting. And if that wasn't obvious, and evidently it wasn't obvious to most parties, then an interpretation section was inserted to make that clear.
Right.
Whether that's the correct position here, I don't know, because it's a different plan change. It's a different NPS, but it may well be. And so that's really what I was seeking guidance about. In Southland, it was important, I think, to have that interpretation section so that you just didn't get the objectives of which were bringing into account Te Mānawatawai and Kiuta Kitai into account under Southland. You just didn't get them being balanced out as two of 18 objectives, and then their sense and sensibility lost, you know, in the great morass of objectives that are there. So that was that plan change, but this is a new NPS, and it seemed to me that, again, the thinking of Te Mānawatawai as the foundational principle was infusing all freshwater decisions. And I had got that, or thought that, from... Why don't I think that? I thought that because of... Clause 1.3 of the NPS, and in particular the subparagraph 2, which says Te Mānawatawai is relevant to all freshwater management, not just to the specific aspects of freshwater management referred to in this NPS, so that Te Mānawatawai was to be brought to bear. In the decisions on the provisions and submissions, that is, on all of the provisions which are in contest at this hearing,
yes.
The foundational principle is being brought to bear a result.
That is the new direction, of course, of this NPS, as opposed to the 2014, as amended in 2017 version. But I think it comes back to the same point. We have a limited plan change that's designed to do a limited role. And I'm not sure about the Southland plan change, but I'm thinking it was on a larger scale.
It was, yeah.
Yes. So given the position particularly that Ngāi Tahu is taking, which is that there's a kind of bottom line, I may be not paraphrasing particularly well from Mr. Winchester in his case, but essentially that there is a kind of bottom line for Te Mānawatawai. It does need to infuse, it does need to be there, it needs to be part of the thinking. But the kind of full effect of the NPS and the full expression of Te Mānawatawai will come later.
Yeah. As I understand the Ngāi Tahu case, that is the case, yeah.
Yes.
Hmm.
Finally, at paragraph 50 on that, I make the point that municipal drinking water is a matter that's also recognised. It's the second priority. And Mr. Ensor has suggested that it's appropriate to provide an exemption to the six-year duration limit for drinking water and PC7, and no doubt that will be part of the planner's review of the drafting.
Mm-hmm.
Turning to the National Policy Statement for Renewable Electricity Generation, which has been with us since 2011. The purpose of the NPS REG is to recognise renewable electricity generation activities and the benefits of renewable electricity generation as matters of national significance under the RMA. I've set out the objective. The key point of the objective, and in this context anyway, is probably the second part, such that the proportion of New Zealand's electricity generated from renewable energy sources increases to a level that meets or exceeds the New Zealand government's national target for renewable electricity generation. It is, of course, also supported by Section 7J of the RMA that provides that particular regard shall be had to the benefits to be derived from the use and development of renewable energy. As I discussed with Mr. Pelsmaker, the NPS REG may be given effect to in PC 7 without locking in large takes by hydro generation, because such takes are not due for reconsenting in the life of this plan change. For example, the Clutha Mata'o scheme, which includes no deemed consents, is not due for reconsenting until 2042. Clutha was completely reconsented under the RMA post 2001, as it was required to be. Ensuring that renewable electricity generation, even small scale, is not curtailed is also important in helping to meet New Zealand's renewable electricity generation target, which is referred to in the objective and which is now 100% by 2030, to assist with mitigating the effects of climate change. In my submission, the ongoing replacement of those hydro consents that fall due in the life of this plan change can be accommodated, particularly those that are non-consumptive, and so give effect to this NPS, given the limited scope of this plan change. And further, that the appropriate place to recognise a national policy statement, given its importance in the hierarchy of documents, is in the body of the plan change rather than in the schedule, as has been mooted.
Sorry, can I just ask you to expand out your paragraph 56? What is it that you're actually suggesting in terms of the plan change?
It will depend on how the planners land, I think, on how to do this. One way I understand that they're considering is simply to provide that an exception so that the six-year consent term doesn't apply to hydro consents. And that was my position, that doing that would not lock in large takes of hydro water. It would hold that position until, in fact, those large takes need to be consented. So it's how the planners are looking at exactly how you frame it within that. But the effect would be to allow longer-term consents other than 6 years, particularly for non-consumptive takes. The drafting is down to the planners.
Right, and so would that have some effect on the work that's been done on the schedule in terms of expert conferencing? How would two things then relate to each other?
I think the way the schedule was approaching it was to put in a kind of exemption. And what I'm saying is that this should be incorporated into the body of the plan change as a position that allows for longer consents for renewable electricity generation, particularly non-consumptive.
And so would that be for everything that was due to expire between now and the magic date, the deemed permits?
It would have the effect of applying to those. The submission is based on the fact that this is a national policy statement, and therefore it's like the NPSFM. It must be given effect to, and coming back to, this is my point with Mr. De Pelsmaker, we can provide for hydro in that way that the NPS requires without having significant environmental effects, given what we know is likely to happen within the scale of this, the time scale of this plan change.
So the devil's in the detail in terms of framing, is that what you suggest?
Well, it's simply that I'm not a planner, so I couldn't actually say exactly how you achieve that outcome. I don't think that it's particularly difficult. I think the real question is exactly if you're going to accommodate effectively allowing some of the deemed permits to be turned into resource consents, exactly how do you provide for it? And do you put it in the schedule as some kind of an exemption, or do you put it into the body of the plan change as a policy position that says this reflects the NPS? Does that make sense?
Is your thinking also contingent on that hydro not then being used for consumptive purposes? So after the water's been put through the turbines, that it's actually returned to the river somewhere as opposed to being used for irrigation and other purposes elsewhere?
Yes, when I say non-consumptive, what is non-consumptive in this plan change is determined by the definition of what is non-consumptive. In this plan change.
So, yes.
And there are, I know that there is an argument about the extent to which some of the trust powers, I think, deemed permits could be determined to be non-consumptive. And I wouldn't go there, that's their position. But council would have to determine in its view whether those met the definition or not.
Mm.
And obviously, from the point of view of the NPS, there is much less of an issue if we're talking about water that is returned to the same waterway within a comparatively short time and space than if the water is taken somewhere else and returned to a different water body, which is why I say that the position is more straightforward for non-consumptive than it is for consumptive uses. But that in this situation, it may be something that the council has to consider because, again, we come back to the scale of this plan change and the scale of the takes that we are that are impacted by the plan change.
Mm.
All
right.
It's an assessment, in my view.
Have you got witnesses at the hydro conference?
No. Wasn't intending to. We haven't called. Mr. Ensor looks at the question of how the NPS REG can be accommodated in this plan change, but it's more at a drafting rather than a hydrological approach.
All right. I think the planning witnesses are attending the hydro conference together with other technical witnesses.
Oh, sorry, Padre, yes. It may be appropriate for Mr. Ensor to attend the Hydro Generation Conference.
If you have an interest and the witness has taken a view or your client has taken a view, it's non-consumptive takes, that some accommodation may be had under this plan change, has a view on what non-consumption means also, and I think there's some differences of opinion there, then it may well be that your witness should be there. I don't know. If you've got a legitimate interest in this, then...
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll talk to Mr. Ensor about that over the lunch break.
All right.
So, turning to some of the opposition to the plan change, some of the suggestions that have been made about ways to deal with the issues that the plan change chooses to address... probably go through these reasonably quickly. The first is the proposal that the same outcomes can be achieved by way of a Section 128 review, and this has come particularly, I think, from the Otago Water Resource Users Group. Section 128 of the RMA allows consent authorities to review the conditions of consent where there is a provision for review in a consent or where there is a need to align consent conditions with the levels, flows, rates or standards set by a regional rule. Does not provide ORC with the authority to cancel consents, and the process is costly. Also, ORC's ability to impose conditions to safeguard the health of freshwater bodies is constrained by the requirement to consider the financial viability of the activity under Section 131 of the RMA. The Minister submits that Section 128 is not a viable alternative to PC7 and would not provide the short-duration consents that the Minister is supporting. Turning to the permitted activity framework, which has also been suggested as an alternative, some submitters have suggested allowing existing water uses to continue as permitted activities until the new plan becomes operative. Mr. De Pelsmaker addresses this and concludes that a permitted activity framework is not appropriate, and he sets that out in his evidence in chief at paragraph 243. It's the cost of activity monitoring is typically borne by the community. It's unclear whether all water takes exercised under a permitted activity rule will achieve the purpose of the RMA, as the effects of these takes will be more difficult to control under a permitted activity regime. It's uncertain whether all existing conditions on resource consents to take and use water can be provided for, and the holders of a current water permit would lose the priority provided under Section 124C of the RMA over persons who are not existing holders of resource consents when applying for a new resource consent under the framework. So the Minister does not support a permitted activity framework, and for the reasons advanced by the Director-General of Conservation, the Minister would be concerned about the environmental implications of the loss of priority. And I'm leaving that to my friend on my left here to explore with you a little more thoroughly. So applying the MPS 2020 as a Section 104 assessment has also been mooted, which of course would mean applying the MPS in the context of consent applications. The MPS FM is not primarily a consenting tool. It's not appropriate in my submission that an instrument at the apex of the planning hierarchy becomes simply a matter to be had regard to, along with other consenting tools and documents. The status of any national policy statement in regard to planned making has already been discussed. Has been a suggestion floating about that relying on Section 127 is a way to deal with these issues rather than PC7, but in my submission that's an inadequate solution. Water permit holders can request a change or a cancellation of a consent condition under Section 127, but the effects which are to be considered are the effects of the change of conditions, not the effects of the consent already granted, and it doesn't address consent duration. And perhaps just one point I'd add in here, having looked quickly at Mr. Winchester's submissions at the end of last week, that there is a suggestion that we've already talked a little bit about Section 124, but that Section 124 could almost be applied and allowed to deliberately applied and allowed to carry on. Mr. Winchester's submission at paragraph 50 last week was that it's Section 124 is not for the purpose of putting an application on hold for an indefinite period while existing rights are exercised without further scrutiny or regulation. And in my submission, that must be right. So turning to the Minister's position, we've talked a lot about the intent being a narrow plan change to hold the line, etc. And as I discussed with Mr. De Pelsmaker last week, really the framework was intended to be a carrot and stick approach, and he confirmed that. That the controlled activity rule would act like the carrot, and it was created to provide applicants with certainty, to be appealing, to be an easy gateway, and the quid pro quo for which was a short-term consent, 6 years. On the other hand, for those who wish to pursue a longer-term consent, the bar was to be set high. And following that logic, the Minister submitted that the non-complying rule should in fact be a prohibited activity rule, which certainly would have set the bar very high. The Minister has retreated from that position and now seeks a tougher non-complying rule that provides for true exceptions. I'll come back to that in a moment. So just dealing with the difficulties which the framework has shown us as it's started to be applied, Mr. Ensor discusses the fact that the controlled activity rule has not in fact operated as a carrot or an incentive to date. Part that's because while the effect of section 86B3 of the RMA gives the notified controlled activity rule legal effect, the existing restricted discretionary activity rule tends to be the applicable one, and the operative water plan also continues to have legal effect. So the matters of discretion that are set out in Rule 12.1.4.8 of the operative water plan covers a broad range of matters, including competing demands for water, minimum flows and effects on groundwater, and regionally significant wetlands, which is likely to require a comprehensive assessment of effects on the environment to accompany any resource consent applications, not dissimilar to the level of assessment that's necessary for an application for resource consent under the PC7 non-complying rule. Now, Mr. Moore, and I took this from his submissions, is suggesting that Council is likely to process these applications more as a controlled activity than a restricted discretionary consents, discussing the weighting that Council will apply to the two plans. But what is important, I think, is the point of view of the applicant. If the application must be lodged effectively for a restricted discretionary activity, it might as well be for a non-complying activity with the hope of a longer consent term. An early decision making the controlled activity rule operative would overcome this issue. Now, I floated that idea last week with Mr. De Pelsmaker, and I think he was thinking about it. And I have floated the idea also with my friends around the room. Everybody can see that if somehow or other we could land on a position for the controlled activity rule, and it were possible to make an early decision on that rule that made it operative, then that would take away some of this issue, the disincentive to use that controlled activity rule that the applicants are experiencing. There are legal questions around doing that, particularly depending on how early Council might be asking the court to make that rule operative, and whether it was done by way of an interim decision, whether it could be subsequently amended. Everybody is thinking about it, I think, and I don't intend to address the court on exactly how it might be done this morning, but really rather to put the idea out there, and if the court is minded to look at the possibility of an early decision on the controlled activity rule, if we could get to a landing on it, then that might be something that we would need to address you on further, everybody, at some point.
How does that controlled activity rule apply without prejudice to parties' position? And there's a lot of parties that say reject the plan change, so
yes,
there's that. So yes, the court have to go through the whole yes hearing to get to the other end, and having heard those submissions.
Yes.
But, so if the primary relief is reject the plan change, how does that submission apply to that? So the court would have to be both deciding those submissions and get itself into a position to reject those submissions, but that there has to be a plan change 7, part of which includes a controlled activity rule.
Yes.
So when you say your friends are thinking about this, does that include ORAC, whose primary position
no
remains?
This is a conversation we haven't had with ORAC. You're raising the very issues that are taxing us.
Mm.
We have thought about what it would require, and effectively it would require the court to make a decision that there will be a PC7.
That's
and there will be
decision
a controlled activity rule.
Mm.
The question I think that is in everybody's mind is, if you were to make an early interim decision that effectively made a rule called a controlled activity rule operative, and especially if you were to do it before you have heard from all the parties, what is the ability to walk back from that and perhaps to tweak it, to make changes to it later in the hearing? And there's been a little bit of sort of looking at case law to see whether, in the circumstances in which an interim decision is not a final decision. That's what I was thinking. If we wanted to pursue this, we would need to look at it a lot more closely.
You would. I mean, just issues of fundamental access to justice, yes. Natural yes. justice, yes. fairness, and, you know, how could the court possibly make a decision without... It can make interim decisions for sure, but how could it possibly make a decision, even on an interim basis, without having heard from the parties to this proceeding? So I think... I can't see my way around that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Perhaps the point would be that it would be an early decision after you have heard from all the parties. Not be a decision that addresses the entire plan change, but makes that rule operative ahead of the rest of the plan change, but on the basis of having heard from everybody.
On the basis of having heard from everybody. And then the second element to that is, to what extent would parties be prepared to engage in a policy framework and a controlled activity rule that a policy framework that results in a controlled activity rule without knowing, therefore, what happens in the rest of the plan change?
Yes.
For example, Mr. Page said that might be considering some merits approach under this plan change. Well, that would be policy plot, you know, some additional policy presumably, and moving in a different sort of, if there's scope, moving in a different sort of space for a merits assessment.
I also need to talk to my friends on my right here who are looking at me very dubiously, but it's not necessarily that both couldn't be accommodated, I would have thought. The point about the controlled activity rule is that if it operates as everybody really quite like it to, you know, it's very straightforward, it's and this is down to the planets, you know, it's certain, it's almost like a yes, I tick that box, then it may be that the other rules can flow from that and the parties can agree on what the controlled activity rule would look like. I'm raising this really in the context of the fact that it's such a the existence of the restricted discretionary rule in the background in this plan change is from what I can see from the evidence that was filed yesterday, from the council, really is proving to be an impediment.
I understand that evidence. And I understand the timing issue as well, and I guess what the regional council's case is now is that the matters of discretion in the controlled activity rule have confounded the plan change somewhat, because instead of becoming being process, it's become process plus environmental. So then again, that starts to look like you're quite a large effort, if you like, in terms of getting the evidence right, such that you've got a consentable proposal for the council to consider. I don't know. We'll have to see. I'm not sure what you want us to do at the moment. Is that just flagging it and you might come back to it later on in the hearing?
Yes. Yeah. I think at the moment it's making the submission that the only way that, in my view, we can resolve this problem, this aspect of the controlled activity rule, lies through killing off the relevance of the old plan change. But I'm not suggesting, to Your Honour, that you necessarily do that at this stage. I'm just putting the issue out there as one that the court might like to think about how it could address as well. And this is one way. That is one way.
All right. Well, I'm not quite sure that I'm going to spend too much time pondering I'm going to get to a controlled activity rule without actually determining the plan change. I don't... see that it is the court's role to step into this breach, if, you know, here, rather that it's for council to raise the issue and to address the law, especially around the administrative aspects of the law, and to place the court in a position where it could be addressing this.
The last thing I would want to do, Your Honour. It may be that when the planners and council and so on meet, some kind of clarity around the controlled activity rule starts to emerge. And
So we have a planners' conference which has been proposed for, I've forgotten what dates now, April, is it? April. That conference was vis-a-vis the schedules. And, you know, as I said this morning, it's always been a concern of the court that parties would go off an expert conference schedules when there are the inputs into those schedules were at large. I don't know to what extent that really does impact the schedules, but it is a concern. We haven't actually yet allowed for time for conferencing, and I think you're talking about mediation of the parties' positions.
Yes.
If you're talking about, you know, conferencing around the planning framework, you know, the objectives and policies and rules, you need to be telling me this soon. Talking about mediation around the same, you need to be telling me this soon so we can schedule that in.
I was more thinking about the informal conferencing that you had suggested and supported, and really thinking that we should be talking more.
Absolutely.
And it may be that, in fact, we reach the point where that can then be turned into formal conferencing, which will take us to the final stage.
Yeah.
Just one last point on that, Your Honour. The last thing I would want my submission to be interpreted as meaning is that parties are in any way disadvantaged or not heard fairly. Obviously, that would not be the Minister's position in this. Mm. It's simply looking at whether or not there is some way through this that would actually be something that all the parties would be comfortable with and which that the court could then act on, find a way to resolve this particular problem that's arisen.
And I suppose that would be on the basis that some permit holders, not all permit holders by any means, but some permit holders might have found a controlled activity rule which just simply turns over the existing consent subject to determination of actual usage highly attractive than having to bother to go down putting the case together both under the operative plan and plan change 7 which does require quite a substantive body of evidence presently under both plans. So it may have been highly attractive to some folk to have just rolled them over and sat on their existing rights for the next 6 years. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And that probably leads me to the point that's made in paragraph 69, that it's how onerous the controlled activity rule had become.
Yeah.
I think it became a lot less onerous last night. Yet to entirely digest where Mr. De Pelsmaker has gone with his proposal. But the point is that the more conditional it becomes, the more difficult it is for the applicant. So at 70, the submission that I've made before, that this rule needs to be certain, it needs to be simple, needs to involve the least amount of discretion or need for assessment on the consenting officer's part. And there was some discussion last week about, you know, if consenting officers are going to get into testing what might mean efficiency, looking at whether or not it's possible to move from races to spray irrigation or whatever, that is going to tie the plan change down.
Yeah.
Obviously makes it difficult to process. Or process consents, rather. And I have said at paragraph 70 that Mr. Rensall's evidence provides a track change version, but he may well want to update that in the light of everything else that's happened. So turning to the non-complying rule, which requires a take and use of surface water to have no more than minor effects, I think by and large a number of parties think that that rule is not sufficiently stringent. Mr. Rensall does analyse it. And again, we may have moved beyond that point. The number of consents being sought and granted under this category actually demonstrates the problem with the non-complying rule. Mm. And Ms Gilroy's evidence at paragraph 33, for example, she talks about the fact that since PC7 was notified, the majority of applications have been for 35 years. That's the problem. We're still back in that space. 35 years aren't being granted, I think it's fair to say, but that's still the way in which this is operating. I should just come back to the controlled activity rule. Well, just one last point on that. I have noticed that the controlled activity rule that Mr. De Pilsmaker is putting up, and I think the non-complying rule, they've certainly become truncated and streamlined and so on. We are getting our heads around exactly what the non-complying rule proposed yesterday actually means, but at the moment there is a slight concern that Mr. Ensor and I were discussing last night that in fact it's gone kind of too far perhaps in terms of not providing for exceptions, not providing for circumstances that might require something else. And on that, I am aware that, and this is very much an interim position, it was a quick look last night, but a matter that I think we need to address, the planners need to address, is that one of the factors that the minister identified, one of the principles that the minister identified in his recommendation and which was reflected back to him from council under recommendation 3, was consideration of potential impacts on existing water abstractors. So that there has to be the ability, in my submission, in this non-complying rule to recognise the true exceptions, to recognise the impacts on water abstractors that are in that level of effect. So the non-complying rule, we're thinking, must allow for something more than 6 years. That doesn't mean 35 years, but there are situations, and that's why the non-complying rule is there, that allow for longer than 6 years in the right circumstances.
Mm.
And that appears to be reflected in the position that the Minister and the Council took back when this all began.
So in this instance, we've got a policy which does actually look like the Minister's submission, original submission,
but
put a full stop is exactly, a full stop on the third policy is exactly where Mr. De Plasmaker has put his full stop.
Yes. Yes.
And so the policy at the moment, which I think from memory says something about avoiding granting more than 6 years, it leaves open the possibility, because you can apply as a non-complying activity, that consent applications will be made for greater than 6 years. Provided that, and I would have thought it was open to the consent authority to grant longer than 6 year permits, subject to the meeting of the second test in section 104 about effects.
Yes, yes.
So if the effects are no more than minor, whatever the wording is under that test, there's a possibility that I didn't see necessarily that the amended policy now forecloses on that. But you're not so sure because
was the question, actually, that Mr. Ensor raised last night when we were looking at it. How does this work? What does that actually mean? And I'm simply making the submission that we've... And the Minister has moved away from the prohibited activity rule, which would have that effect, that
they
doesn't want to foreclose that entirely, recognising... but there will be circumstances.
And are you talking about effects? You're talking about applications which have, which will meet one of the threshold tests for in section 104D, and in particular the threshold test pertaining to effects. Or are you talking about something else? And that's, of course, the difficulty with trying to imagine what that application might be, is that you can't, yes. And then something else, or you think you do, and something else comes through.
That's exactly right. That is the problem with trying to actually envisage what the circumstances will be. I think the question, it's a question of drafting, actually. And it may be that when the planners get together, everyone can understand exactly how that operates.
Mm.
At the moment, on the face of it, it looks like it could potentially operate more like a prohibited activity rule. But as I say, that's on the basis of a quick look last night, and I'm really making the point that in the Minister's submission, a rule that operates like a prohibited activity has kind of swung too far the other way.
No, I saw that there, and I was reading the submission from the Minister today and yesterday. The Council now looks to have gone in the direction of the Minister's submission as to the wording of the policy, and it may well be that the Minister might have felt that his where he put the full stop and deleting the balance of the words from the policy was a step too far as well. It could be just a drafting, but it could also be, it may be important to understand from the Regional Council how it is that policy is intended to implement and give effect to the objective. So again, to understand what are the four corners. I know from practical experience, so trying to imagine what that non-compliant activity might look like is impossible, and it's fraught with risk. So it is better to have a clear statement as to outcome with policies as to how that is to be achieved.
Mm. And if we are to hear from Mr. De Pelsmaker this afternoon, that may be something that he can clarify for us.
Mm.
Your Honour, I think I can stop there. I've set out the basic things that the Minister is now seeking by way of relief, and the fact that we are calling two witnesses, probably only one today, and I think Mr. Ensor more likely tomorrow after the plan. I think that was the outcome.
I think that's it. So we'll hear from your policy planner today, and I think that we were then going to go back to the ORC's witnesses. Is that what we're doing? No, we're going to hear from, we will hear from Doc first.
The only, I, in terms of my opening, Your Honour, I actually am quite comfortable and relaxed about when that happens.
It's your policy, it's your person's constraint. Okay.
And so if we're going to hear from the ORC witnesses today, then, and I have to say this is me speaking off the cuff, Your Honour, I have not put this to anybody else. I wondered then whether we potentially could sit for an hour tomorrow morning to just make sure we got through Dr. Dunn. That's just an option I'm putting out there. That would still mean that the planners would have time to work, but it just, as I say, I've got this constraint with Dr. Dunn.
Okay.
I need to get his evidence through.
So in terms of the party's case, who do they really need to hear from next as far, or they really need to hear from Mr. De Pleismaker? And they don't really need to hear from... They do need to hear from the other witnesses, but it's not critical that they go next. Would that be fair?
I think that to be the case.
Yep. All right, everybody's... Yep. So that might still leave you a little exposed.
Yes, Your Honour. So I guess I'm in your hands as to whether you're prepared to hear the Director General's witness without having heard the opening.
Oh, okay, rather not, but when does your witness have to leave? By tomorrow morning?
He needs to be gone by, I think it's... he's handing me his schedule.
That's his tickets?
His ticket. He needs to be at the airport by 2:40, so he needs to leave Dunedin by 2 o'clock.
Okay, so we'll hear... I would think that we've got sufficient time to hear from your witness next, Ms Dixon, then to hear from the OIC's planner, and then to move to your case in the morning. We'll hear your submission and hear your witness. Does that sound like a fair enough plan? Anybody got any concerns with that? I've got to get the doc witness on and out or the... Yep.
Yeah, our only constraint is catching up with our clients tomorrow.
Oh, yeah,
morning.
You actually do need to. Yeah. I'd like you to do it.
Probably, I think we'd almost
Oh, because we had actually booked in half a day off.
Yes. Mm. So 9 o'clock tomorrow morning is slightly challenging for us.
No, fair enough. You've got a lot of people that'll be in the room. So maybe we'll hear from your minister's witness next, and we'll start the DOC case, and we'll just have to go with the ORC case the following day in the afternoon.
We could perhaps run slightly late this evening if the court were able to accommodate that to hear from Dr. Dunn.
Oh, we'll get to Dr. Dunn, I would have hoped, but yeah. Ms. Dixon.
The question is the sequence, I think, whether we hear from Dr. Dunn before Mr. DePelsmaker, is it?
I don't think we're getting Mr. DePelsmaker on.
There are for Dr. Dunn. We need to deal with that constraint.
We
need to hear from him this afternoon.
Yep. All right, we'll see how we go. Maybe sitting late to get the region's planner on. Is that okay?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honour.
All right. So we'll hear your witness next, then we'll move to the DOC case so we can get the submissions in and the DOC witness on, and then we'll interpose that with the planning witness for ORC, maybe sitting late, just depends on how we're going.
Thank you, Ron.
All right, everyone happy with that? Very good. We'll take tomorrow morning off because we said that and you've planned around that. We should. All right, so we'll adjourn for an hour, 2 o'clock. All rise.